accession number 26868, reel 5.
This is the third reel of a taped interview with Max Gamble in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 30th of the 12th, 2003, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. I wanted to just bring you back a little way, because I understand you were to go to Malta following your time in North Africa. What do you recall of the end of the North African campaign?
Actually, I went direct from the operational training unit in Kia in Palestine to Malta to join a strategic reconnaissance unit called 1437, and they were forming up in Malta.
What year was that? Do you recall?
It was about August.
I'm interested in that. If
August 43.
May 43, we have the end of what people call the African War. What did you know of that situation?
Very little, apart from just the sort of odd headlines that were in the various places, because I was in training at that time.
What were the headlines reading?
I can't remember. No.
Roughly.
Just that the war was, as far as we're concerned, was progressing well, and that Montgomery had driven Rommel out of Africa, together with the Fifth Army from Algiers. I think it was the Fifth.
I wanted to discuss the general situation in relation to how you then saw your position, given the fact that the Germans were now out of Africa, as it were.
Well, we knew we'd be continuing to follow them wherever they went. So that, in fact, is what happened. So that arrived in Malta, joined up with the squadron people, and then the Sicilian landing had just occurred, and we moved to a very rough airfield in southern Sicily.
What did you know of Malta?
Nothing very much.
It was an important strategic position.
Oh, it was very, very much so. And the Maltese themselves were very much on our side. That was helpful.
Can you describe Malta to us in 43, when you were there?
Bomb craters everywhere. The airstrip was largely made of stuff on top of rock, and the bombs were dropped on it endlessly, but they just sort of hit, dug a few more rocks out, and then those were filled in again, and so it continued. It was an important one because of the fleet, and also the RAF PRU, which was the Photographic Reconnaissance Unit, which used special Spitfires, which had no guns, and the wings were full of petrol tanks. And they had a very long focus length camera, vertical overlap camera, and they flew from Britain over Germany, photographing all the way to Malta. Their cameras were reloaded, and when they'd had a bit of a rest, they turned around and did the same thing on the way back. So Malta was very important in lots of ways.
What was the atmosphere on Malta in 43, August 43?
Quite good. Quite good. Everybody was hopeful that the Everything had taken a change for the better. Then when we got into Sicily, there was lack of supplies and food and petrol and so on. It was a little bit airy there for a while.
Well, let's talk about that experience. How long were you to be in Malta for?
Oh, it was only about a week, I think, if I remember correctly.
What were you being told in relation to your next move to Sicily, for instance?
Well, it was a foregone conclusion because that was the Eighth Army that did that. And we were just to follow the Eighth Army, more or less, in the tactical reconnaissance side, or strategic reconnaissance side.
Was there any hope at this stage that the Italians would opt out of the war?
Well, strange you should mention that, because the first so-called airfield we went to, which wasn't really an airfield, it was just a bulldozer striped down through the vines and so on. One day we're not flying and we're sitting there, and a Sicilian peasant arrived with two buckets of fairly ferocious red wine. And we had trouble finding somebody to interpret what was going on, but we managed to do it in the end. He just heard on the radio that there was a chance, a likelihood, that Mussolini would collapse, and he thought it was a damn good idea would we all celebrate with him. So that didn't happen for another, I think it was 8 or 9 months, but that was the beginning. From that airstrip, we moved to one more or less in central Sicily as the army forces gradually took over Sicily, and a place called Francesco. And there was a fair amount of activity there with several squadrons, a much better strip, still just earth, and a fuel dump, and a bit of a hospital. And one night, moonlight night, three haystacks went up in strategic areas, and the next moment the Ju-88s were in, and they bombed the airfield, they bombed the fuel dump, and then in the moonlight they strafed us all, which was a bit hairy. You couldn't see anything. I didn't even have a tent. I was sleeping under an olive tree with a camp bed and a mosquito net. So the only thing to do was sit under the tree and on the bed. And two fellows were hit about 10 meters from the bed. There were people rushing all over the place. The South African people had some African troops who had not been under fire before, and they panicked and rushed into the river and swamps and so on. And after the big trouble was over, we had to go trying to look for these people and pull them out.
Can you describe to us the feeling of being strapped at night time when you couldn't really see or know where the bullets might be hitting next?
Well, you're naturally scared, but the thing was that there was the impotence of it all. You couldn't do anything. Main thing was just stay where you were and hope for the best.
People talk of luck being...
Oh, very much so. Luck does come in.
So what sort of philosophy do you adopt?
A bit of a fatalist, I think. Otherwise you wouldn't be able to carry on.
In relation to seeing this destruction and death happening around you, was it ever difficult to sort of pick yourself up and carry on?
It didn't take all that time to get to sort of accept that that was going to happen and was happening. And one just carried on and did what you were supposed to do. The main town of Sicily, Catania, fell to the army whilst we were in that airfield, Francesco. So we took a truck and went in and managed to get a bit of equipment for our mess by raiding the ex-German headquarters and the fascist headquarters there, if that was the block. They were opposite each other in this block in Catania. We got enough stuff to make the mess a little bit more habitable.
You mentioned that things were a bit dicey early on. You mentioned obviously the strafing, but how strong was the resistance, the German resistance?
It was a bit spasmodic. What was happening with the army people, we didn't really know, because there was very little communication in that respect. From Francesco, we moved further north to near the Tower, towards the Tower of Italy, to a place called Reggio, and operated from there for a while.
And what were your duties to be Reggio?
Well, at that time, the 1437 Stratar flight had virtually run out of the aircraft they were using, which was the early Mustang, the A36, with the Allison engine, which was quite good at low level, but useless up at any height. So we were there with only just one Spitfire amongst us, so they decided to send us on. Most of us went to 225 Squadron RAF, which was operating Spitfires on tactical reconnaissance. That was closer in reconnaissance, not so far ahead of the army, whereas the strategic one was a long distance into enemy territory. The aircraft we were using were Spitfires 5, which were a bit different than the other Spitfires, that they had what was called a cropped blower. See, they were highly supercharged with a blower which was driven through gears from the engine. And these ones had a cut-down blower, which meant that there was less power consumed in driving the blower, so that they could produce more power low down. But when they went to any height, they ran out of steam because the blower couldn't keep up the air pressure to the engine. The other thing about them was that they had clipped wings, similar to the one that is at Bull Creek on the stand. The wingtip was cut off, the reason being to allow more flexibility in the roll, so that you could quickly turn much quicker with the wingtips off. So, from there, we then moved to the, on 225 Squadron, moved to the Toe of Italy, and gradually went round Italy on the east and northeast coast from the Toe of Italy, keeping up behind the 8th Army.
At this stage, things are looking fairly healthy for the Allies, I would have thought. thought, given that they just consolidated North Africa?
Yes. Turned the corner. Everybody was much happier.
Well, I was going to ask...
One thing I did miss when I was talking about the 1437 Stradhouse flight, because these planes had not been seen very often, a lot of the pilots were on the fighter squadrons were not very good on aircraft recognition. And one of our chaps going out over the sea, low level, he saw this Spitfire turn and come at him and then come at him again. So he said, that fellow's trying to shoot me down, so he decided he'd get in first. So he took a shot at this Spitfire and carried on low level and didn't see the Spitfire again. So he carried on his reconnaissance. On the way back, he was hit in the radiator by ground fire. And when he got over the sea, he had to bail out. And he wasn't in the water for very long when a walrus, which was the SE rescue thing, came and picked him up. He couldn't understand how quick it had happened, but what had happened was his shot had been correct. He'd knocked the Spitfire out that was trying to shoot him down, and he was in the water and he'd been picked up when he came in. And eventually in that aircraft they found out what had happened, so there was a bit of a free-for-all. But I went back a bit there.
That's okay. I was going to ask how this sort of turning of the corner showed itself in not only morale, but the sort of performance of the men.
Morale definitely was high, but I think the performance of the people stayed fairly static. In other words, they were doing their job properly. So to continue with the 225 squadron, we were operating generally in the reconnaissance at about 8,000 to 10,000 feet, a lot depending on how intense the ACAC was, and whether it was medium ACAC or high-level ACAC. But wherever we went, the ACAC was fairly intense because they knew what we were up to, that we were in fact getting an eye on what was going on. And if it wasn't very windy and sunny, you could more or less look behind you and see 50 miles where you'd gone by the smoke from the bursts of the light and heavy ACAC. A small cloud, in fact, formed in the line that you'd gone. So the amount of rounds that were expended was enormous every time you went up.
You mentioned that you were sort of developing this fatalist attitude, but how did you manage to get yourself up each time, knowing that you were always going to have this huge amount of flak to deal with?
First couple of times were a little bit scary. After that, you began to get a bit used to it. And, well, I don't suppose used to it was correct, but you accepted that that was going to happen, and there was a good chance either way. That was it.
Had you had any close shaves with enemy aircraft?
Enemy aircraft, no. We didn't have many problems with that. They generally came, it was a sort of hit and run at some specific target, and we just happened to be incidental with just two aircraft on the way, so very often they just went past. I would come to going through the middle of a Focke-Wulf squadron later, if it, in the sequence of this. We then got to the sort of Brindisi area in Italy and moved to the plains of Foggia, which was a fairly central sort of area there, and we were stationed there for quite a while because the Germans suddenly put up very much more resistance. And on both sides of Italy, on the southern side or southwest side, they'd run into a big operation, resistance at the Volturno River. And when they got through that, there was Monte Cassino, which I think everybody's heard about, of the resistance there. And on the east as well, on northeast coast, so that we were a much longer period at Foggia, just doing the normal recce, which was then passed on to the army. And one of the hairy jobs was to pick up the photographs that have been taken by the PRU, which I mentioned earlier, of the chaps coming through from UK, and dump them on the army headquarters. Now, the army headquarters were right on the bomb line, and usually they didn't put them on the top of the hill because they're obvious, they're down in a ruddy dip. They insisted you drop them at about the stall speed and at about maximum of 100 feet. So that very often doing all those and trying to get this bundle of things out of a little cockpit which was like this was very difficult when you're trying to control an aircraft, get those out, stop it from stalling and stopping yourself from crashing in. When we used Hurricanes, we had an old Hurricane on the squadrons, it was easy because they had a bigger cockpit. But in the Spitfire, it was very difficult because these things were heavy. You see, it was a block about that cubed.
About a foot square?
Yeah, to drop onto the army headquarters. And half the time, our own people, the army, were shooting at you because they thought you were German. The Germans were shooting at you from the other side, so there were things going all directions. And one day I had trouble with the thing, I got it stuck a bit there. And I went straight through an olive tree. Fortunately, by the time I touched the olive tree, I opened the throttle full, and I came out the other side without any major damage. But that was one of the jobs we didn't like doing.
I was going to ask if you suffered much from friendly fire.
I think probably more than we knew, because you just didn't know it. Because somebody shooting at you with a 303 rifle or something like that, you didn't know. Until you landed and there was a hole through. I got hold with something like a 303 when I was in Yugoslavia.
Do you recall September the 8th, 1943, the Italians surrendering?
Yes, we were at Foggia. And just at that time, we were still near Foggia, but on a strip near the sea. And a sailing boat came in. A chap came out of it, and said, any Australians here? And they pointed to me, they aimed to me. He was Nicky Barr, who had been the CO of the Australian Squadron 3 Squadron. He'd been shot down twice, I think it was, in North Africa, taken prisoner by the Italians. And in the process of the surrender, he bolted. And he actually got it mixed up with the people trying to help any Italian POWs. This chap, I think, was a professor, and he had a sailing boat. So he sailed him down the Adriatic until he reckoned he was in friendly area and dumped him out. So that's why I remember that it was just at that time.
What did it mean to you to hear the Italians were giving up?
Everybody was happy about that because it meant everything was much easier in continuing the advance up Italy, people being more with you than being forced against you. But the Italians never really put up any tremendous resistance, really. They weren't interested in war.
Well, I've heard some fairly good stories of their aircraft.
We didn't see much of their aircraft at all by that time. They were pretty well... If they saw another aircraft, most times they turned and went the other way, so... There was an interesting thing, though, that after the Italian surrender, some of the Italian pilots who were mercenaries, had been in the Spanish Civil War, approached the RAF to let them have a squadron of planes and fight against the Germans, because they didn't like the Germans one little bit. And they happened to be based on the same airstrip as we were at one stage. The powers that be gave them Baltimore twin-engine bombers. These were really hardcore people. They were very good pilots. They were aggressive. And they did a damn good job for the Allies. Was interesting.
How are mercenaries seen?
Well, we used to see them in the mess and so on, have a drink with them, and most of them could speak some English and all friendly. No problem at all.
Here you are in Italy now, and obviously flying planes. What was it like to be in Italy, 1943, even though there was a war on?
It was fairly reasonable, really. There didn't seem to be much in the way of sabotage going on. I mentioned sabotage before, where the bombing of Francesco airstrip. Obviously, they had some hardcore people there to pinpoint them with the burning haystacks at night. But we didn't come across it very much. In fact, I don't think I can recall any problems we had on the aircraft where they were congregated, parked. Food was pretty short. What we did at Foggia was to get extra food. We couldn't get it from the locals because they didn't have it, but they had plenty of olive oil. And olive oil was very short in the mountains, and they'd swap anything for it. And we found this out by accident, and we managed to get the group captain to agree to a truck. We bought the olive oil at the coast, took it up the mountains and swapped it for chickens and turkeys and vegetables and so on, anything in the way of food line to improve the mess standard.
News from home?
Rare. The only way with these little pieces of paper, were, which were the, not the foolscap size, the other size, where it had all been condensed into a, onto a little thing like this, and then blown up again afterwards. And that mail went from here.